Why don't we get started? Welcome. On such a wonderful day, I'll assume that it's just because it's cold outside that you came. But we are enormously grateful to all of you for coming. We are, as always, particularly grateful to the family of Danilo Strug for their firm and continued support. I hear the elevator, so someone's coming. It's a great pleasure. It's 16 years since Danilo died. I've just started. It's been 16 years since Danilo died.
No, not yet.
It will be in 3 weeks or a little. That'd be nice. I'm sorry, I wasn't counting every day. I needed that line to say that every single year we have honored his memory. And so this is the 16th Danilo Husar Strug Memorial Lecture. That's a long time. And we've had some very good talks. The others were even better. And we've had some outstanding people give the talks. Looking over the list of people, the first one, if you remember that far back, was Marco Paulician. Right? And we've had the usual suspects and some unusual suspects. And I'm always on the hunt for anyone I don't know of who studies Ukrainian literature and can give a talk in English. That is, we instituted this series of lectures very deliberately to be in English and to be meant to popularize Ukrainian literature on an academic level, but into a wider audience, not just into the audience of the Ukrainians who are specialists or already know the field. And without patting myself on the back too much, I think we've done well with your support. I think we've made Danilo proud. This year, we have another very fine speaker, Professor George Mihaichuk of Georgetown University, who has been in Toronto before, that I know. How familiar he is to you, well, that I can't say. Professor Mihaichuk is at Georgetown University, where he endures the Washington environment. I had to get that in there. Don't avoid political jokes, but one's okay. And he is the incoming chair of his department, and so he deserves a great deal of our sympathy, since that that is not a happy prospect for anyone, and I'm sure that he will do a good job, but he'll probably run away from it the moment they release him. Professor Mihaichuk's academic career goes back to familiar turf for us, because he is not only a professional colleague, but he's an old friend. We were in graduate school together, although he was in the other department. That is, he was a Slavist and I was a comparatist, but his degrees are from Harvard University, from the Slavic department, where way back when, it was 90, right? In 1990, he defended his dissertation on Chekhov. Since then, he has been doing a number of various things. His record of publication includes work on Oleś Honchar, on the Renaissance of the 1920s in Ukraine, on Chekhov, of course, on Yuri Lotman, one of his, right? He's got a wonderful essay on Russian views of Napoleon. I think it's very El Quran today. We should go back to these kinds of topics, right? And of course, since he's at Georgetown, a fair amount of his work is focused on teaching Russian. The Ukrainian program there is only there because he lets it be there. And as chair, he will probably redouble his efforts to boost the Ukrainian program. Professor Mihaichuk is involved in two particular long-term projects. One is in the hands, as I understand it, of the Canadian Institute of Ukraine Studies Press, and that is a collection of translations of Vinnichenko's plays, which is something, of course, that I'm particularly interested in. I put great stock in translation, and hopefully, I'm not sure exactly what stage that project is in at the press, but hopefully before too long, such a volume will appear. His other major project, of which today's talk is no doubt an instance of, is on Romantic nationalism and Ukrainian high culture. That is, he is exploring the early 19th century efforts to establish Ukrainian culture, but not just to establish it, that is, as you will hear in a moment, that is, his idea is how Ukrainian culture has to rise to the level of a high culture as it's understood in that period. You didn't come here to listen to me, so I will cut myself short here and invite you all to welcome Professor Mihaichuk, who will read us a talk on The Curse of the Province in Early 19th Century Ukrainian Literature. Welcome.
Thank you, Maxime, for the kind words. The title of this talk points to an issue that gained prominence with the rise of Ukrainian literature in the early 19th century, and that continued to resonate throughout the century and in literary scholarship to this day. The curse I'm referring to concerns viewing Ukraine as a province and Ukrainian literature as provincial. For Ukrainian literature, being provincial was a mixed blessing. In the eyes of the imperial centers, Moscow and St. Petersburg, Ukraine was an intriguing, somewhat exotic province of the empire, often referred to in travelogue literature by Russian authors as Nasha Asconia, Nasha Italia. And the literature was perceived as entertaining, light fare, offering local color, but minor rather than serious literature or high culture. That is, it was provincial in the negative sense. From the point of view of Ukrainian authors and readers, the distance from the centers enabled the Ukrainian province to more easily preserve particularities of its tradition and ethnos. But the curse is that the very literary features that initially shaped a distinct identity and that distinguished it from the literature of the imperial centers was also what consigned it to a minor status. My argument is that distinctiveness is only part of the struggle facing Ukrainian literature, and that the more crucial and thorny issue for Ukrainian literature and for emerging literatures in general is attaining dignitas. What I suggest then is a shift in the approach to examining Ukrainian literature, to consider it in terms of a pursuit of dignity, a struggle for status. As Gorovich has stated, one of the most interesting questions regarding the rise of a new Ukrainian literature is the search for a high style. The notion of distinctiveness, of Ukrainian particularism, has become well established in discussions of Ukrainian literature of the imperial period, particularly in discussions of the early Ukrainian literature of the 19th century. This is evident in the works of Lutsky, Grabovich, Kandry, Borzenko. In the late 18th century and early 19th century, both Russians and Ukrainians were concerned with defining their own identities and their national narratives. Within the imperial narrative, Ukraine was viewed as a province contributing to the Obshchoruski nation that consisted of Great Russian, Little Russian, and White Russians, what Alexei Miller has called the Triune Nation. For Ukrainians, however, the narrative was more complicated, inasmuch as they had to negotiate the imperial Obshchoruski identity while seeking to preserve their own Maloroshsky identity. From the early 19th century to the 1840s, archaeological digs, archival research, and publication in Ukrainian were allowed by imperial authorities, in part as an interest in the provinces and territories of the empire, and in part as a strategy to overcome unwanted Polish influence. Ukrainian writers were publishing works on Ukrainian themes in the major Russian journals of the day, presenting the particular world of their province with its history and ethnos, which, while different from that of the imperial center, could still be integrated into a larger whole and was of interest to Russian as well as Ukrainian readers. The horizon of expectations and response toward Ukrainian literature was partially shaped by Kotlyarevsky's Eneida, the first three parts of which were published in 1798, and the less talented imitators that followed. This earthy mock epic with a Ukrainian glossary, filled with Cossacks and the particularities of Ukrainian life, presented a distinctive world that was popular even among Russian readers. It also spawned a number of secondary works that imitated Kotlyarevsky's style and came to be pejoratively known as Kotlyarevshchina. The traits of this writing, a chatty, familiar tone, a simple-minded narrator, often a peasant, play with the reader, rather lowbrow types, coarse speech, and earthy body humor, were viewed as characteristic of Ukrainian literature, such as it was, and not to be found in the Russian literature of the day, as Sipovsky has pointed out in his 1928 study, Ukraine and Russian Literature, 1800 to 1850. While Kotlyarevsky himself has largely been spared sharp criticism, Kotlyarevshchina has been attacked by Zerov and Chizhevsky for its putatively low aesthetic quality and bad taste, but defended by Grabovich. Both sides concede that this kind of writing is characteristic of early 19th century Ukrainian literature, with Grabovich pointing out that the burlesque was largely the only genre at the beginning of the early modern Ukrainian literature, and so it resonated for much longer and established the prism through which Ukrainian literature was viewed. But he also points to what he sees as a deeper positive significance, that this literary style served as a basic model of self-identification. He goes on to say, "The external function of this verbal style is to further separate Ukrainian from all Russian literature through the choice of linguistic code." And he emphasizes its Bakhtinian sense of parody of canonic, i.e. Russian literature. In this separation of Ukrainian nashe from Russian ne nashe, Grabovich favors the underlying distinct modality over overt genre or formal features. But if the distinguishing features of this modality are taken to be characteristic of Ukrainian literature, this consigns Ukrainian literature to low literature that is defined by opposition to high canonic literature. And if the overriding concern is to define one's space by rejecting whatever the high canonic literature may be, then one has to ask what future path was left for Ukrainian literature. Framing the discussion in this fashion is to reconsider some of the points raised by Grabovich in his critique of Chizhevsky. Chizhevsky viewed Ukrainian literature of this period through the lens of high genres prevalent in both Europe and Russia, and found Ukrainian literature circumscribed and lacking, as incomplete. Within the neoclassical canon, the burlesque texts in Ukrainian are characterized as low genres, and in an evaluative sense, are viewed as provincial. A critique of this approach has been based on a cultural anthropological approach that treats cultures as justified in their own right, as arising from and serving the needs of their own community, people, or nation. In this view, provincial becomes a descriptive term, designating a native culture, Ukrainian, different from that of the center, St. Petersburg, Moscow. I am bringing up this issue not for polemical reasons, but to suggest that the evaluative sense of provincial actually has a place in a historical consideration of the development of Ukrainian literature. One cannot dispense with evaluation if the question is framed as canonic versus anti-canonic, because the one must be measured against the other. Furthermore, Ukrainian writers of the day were aware of and sought to overcome the negative connotation of provincial by seeking to create a Ukrainian high or serious literature. This concern resonated throughout the 19th century, and there are grounds for arguing that it already surfaces from the very beginnings of modern Ukrainian literature in the early 19th century. Given the prevalence of the time of Kotlyarevshchina, its particular narrative modality and style, one can take it as a baseline, as it were, for Ukrainian literature. It resonated not only in works of minor writers, but also in the correspondence, pinpricks, besulki, supliki, forewords, and literary works of Kotlyarevsky, Gulak, Kvitka, Hrebinka, and even Shevchenko. But despite the prevalence of this narrative and stylistic modality, it is not the only register Ukrainian authors wrote in, whether in Russian or Ukrainian. These writers also published works in Russian and leading Russian journals, and certainly read the Russian journals of the day, as their correspondence attests. The point is not that they or many educated Ukrainian readers were bilingual, but that despite living in a province, these writers were well aware of the current literary discussion and literary works in the empire. And they themselves differentiated between popular light fare, the comic opera, anecdotes, low genres, and more serious literature, even if loosely defined. They were also sensitive to the dismissive attitude toward the literature of travesty in Ukrainian. If literature in Ukrainian up to 1819 was initially defined for Russian and Ukrainian readers by the modality of Kotyarevsky's Aeneida, Hulak's Panta Sobaka, 1818, and Deshcho pro togo Horaska, 1819, and by lesser well-known imitators like Kosciuszko-Kmitnitsky's, an ode composed in the Maloroссийskie Narechie, the Ukrainian language, on the occasion of raising the militia, 1807, we need to remember that we also encounter Kotyarevsky's Natalka Poltavka in 1819. Admittedly only on stage, since it was not available to a broader audience until publication in Sryzniewski's Ukrainski Zbornik in 1838. There is a shift already occurs in this text that not only provides a corrective to the distortion of Ukrainian life, customs, etc., in Chekhovskoy's Kazakh Stikhotvorets, 1812, but also provides a counter-definition or modality to the existing notion of literature in Ukrainian. An alternative arises that differentiates itself from the characteristics of this modality, not merely as another kind of literature, but in an evaluative sense as anti-Kotyarevshchina. To illustrate the dynamics of the relationship between the two modalities, I would like to consider certain issues regarding translation, language, and some of the literary works of the day. The study of translations has established a place for itself in present literary scholarship. Among the leading questions it poses are the choice of text translated, the language into and by which it is translated, high, low, dialect, and the style, genre features, literary traditions, fidelity to the original. The choices made by the translator provide telling signs about a native culture, about what texts were deemed of interest and could enrich the native culture. In the context of early 19th century Ukrainian literature, the choices also have a bearing on the two modalities in question. Among the translations of Ukrainian authors of the time, one finds classical, neoclassical, and contemporary works, and translation into Russian and Ukrainian. Even a cursory examination of authors and texts allows one to draw certain conclusions. The first pertains to what was translated into Russian and what was translated into Ukrainian. Kotlyarevsky translated Oda Sappho in 1817, one of Sappho's odes, into Russian via Boileau's, it's the best I can do with my French, I apologize, French translation, although it was only published in 1843 in Molodik. The text is written in the high style, as understood in educated literary circles at the time, elevated lexicon, some church Slavonicisms, Kladny, Vnemnit, Objemnit, a solemn tone that is an absence of features that figure in the burlesque or travesties. Furthermore, it follows the tradition of translation of Sappho by Russian poets, Derzhavin, Zhukovsky, and Pushkin, that is high literature translated in a poetic style. The early translations of Hulak, which appeared in Ukrainsky Vestnik, 1816-19, were of established neoclassical poets, Rousseau, Racine, Delille, Crébillon, Milton, translated into literary Russian, again in a poetic style. The point is that serious literature could not be translated in a burlesque style without being viewed as parody. And as Kotyarevsky and Hulak recognized, such translations require the appropriate poetic diction, style, and genre features of high literature that Russian already afforded. The choice to translate high literature into Ukrainian develops gradually and engenders the discussion as to whether the language is capable of adequately conveying the original. The very modality that characterized Ukrainian literature and conveyed Ukrainian distinctiveness is not adequate for translating high literature into high literature. Hulak's Oda Parhoma 1 and 2 are not translations of Horace, though they rely on his text, to Delia to Levkanoi. They are travesties or parodies, perelitsuvanya, in the burlesque modality, as Zerov has pointed out. Translation of serious literature forced Ukrainian authors to move out of the modality of Kotyarevshchina into a new realm that required a different lexicon and tone. This is readily apparent with the literary ballad, which at the time was in vogue throughout Europe and among Russian authors. Kulak himself reworked two ballads, Mickiewicz's Pani Twardowska and Goethe's Ballad der Fischer. The latter translation was published in Vestnik Europe in 1827, that is at the same time as his Oda Parchoma, but in an entirely different modality. The reworking of Horace follows the line established by Kotorevsky, while the translation of Goethe follows a line of high literature that cannot be translated in the terms provided by Kotorevshchina. The translation was published with an excerpt from Hulak's letter to the editor, Kachanovsky, in which Hulak considered, if it was possible, this is the quote, if it was possible to express in Little Russian language tender, fine, and uplifted feelings without forcing the reader to laugh, as in the case of Kotorevsky's Eneida and other poems written in a similar vein. Here we have a clear indication of the opposition between the two modalities and the feeling of inadequacy of the one for conveying the other. Just as Hulak struggled to elaborate an appropriate style for Goethe's ballad, so did Hrebinka in his efforts to translate Pushkin's Poltava. Stricha, in his Ukrainsky Khudozhny Pereklad, explains the shortcomings of Hrebinka's efforts, published in 1836, as due to the absence of models of a high style in Ukrainian, and praises his emphasis on the Ukrainian colorit. That is, Stricha argues that contemporaries already knew the poem in Russian, in the Russian original, and wanted a Ukrainian version of poem rather than a close translation. However, a Ukrainian colorit is not sufficient of itself. One should remember that even Ukrainian contemporaries were critical of Hrebinka's efforts. Kostomariov, in his Obzor sочинений, писаних на малороссийском наречии, in 1844, described it as a valiant but flawed effort. I quote, the writer recognizes that the language used by Kotlarevsky and Artemovsky to entertain the public is not in any way a distorted variant of Russian. In his works, he wanted to show the capabilities of the language for development and richness. His translation, truth be told, was not a success. Of course, the Romantics took a more critical view of their predecessors, but at issue is the awareness that some of the lexical choices and tone were characteristic of a modality, or Kotlarevshchina, and not appropriate for conveying the tone and style of Pushkin's text. What Kostomariov intimates is the need to develop a high literary style for translations of high literature. This need to establish a Ukrainian high style is evident in Hulak's later translations of some psalms. In Hulak's eyes, the subject matter, the divine, requires an appropriate, elevated literary language, and so he enhances the Narodna Mova by including Slavonicisms, a marker of the high style in neoclassicism. As Stricha points out in these texts, Hulak uses the six-foot iamb, the alexandrin, of academic and classical Russian verse to provide models of a Ukrainian high style. There were significant achievements in translation where Ukrainian attained a level of excellence, as in Borovikovsky's Ukrainian translation of Mickiewicz's Faris and Stiep Akermansky, which appeared in Vestnik Europe in 1830 to a Russian audience without a note of explanation or apology, and as proof of the ability of the language for use in high culture. And Mytlinsky, in his poetry collection, Dumki i Pisni ta Shche Deshcho, of 1839, had a separate section for actual translations, that is, not travesties, from Polish, Czech, Slovak, and German. They are closer to the motifs of folklore, but also far from the modality of travesty. As David Cooper has shown in his study, Creating the Nation, Identity and Aesthetics in Early 19th Century Russia and Bohemia, translation plays a significant role in the formation of a national identity. This became a lively issue in the literary debates of the day in the Russian Empire, particularly as Russians themselves discussed the extent to which Russian translators should adhere to a foreign text. Rather than slavish imitation of the original, the prevailing opinion argued for assimilative imitation, that is, to follow a model but adapt it to one's own literary traditions, natural setting, and customs. This topic forms the debate between the ancients and the moderns in French literature, hence its resonance in the Russian Empire, and has relevance for Ukrainian translation. The issue then is not simply the presence of a Ukrainian colorit, local color, distinctive characteristics in itself, but the appropriate treatment of the original content or material. Thus, despite Stricha's praise for Hrebinka's introducing Ukrainian local color into his translation of Poltava, Hrebinka could not express the appropriate style and elevated lexicon and tone of the original. This was not a question of the capability of the language. Stricha introduces Borowikowski's translation to Crows, Dva Vorony, a reworking of Pushkin's ballad, Dva Vorony, which itself was a translation of the Scottish ballad, The Twa Corbies, that appeared in an edition of Walter Scott's Minstrelsy of the Scottish Border, that ended up in a prose translation in French in 1826. Pushkin adapts the ballad to a Russian setting and tradition. We have a Voronaya Kobylka, not a hunting dog. We have the dead hero not lying beyond yonder hill, but in a chistom pole pod rakitoy. And we have a Molodaya Khajaika instead of a lady fair. Stricha has praise for Borowikowski's treatment of the ballad with its Ukrainian traits because it sustains the tone and style of Pushkin's version. That is, Borowikowski finds the appropriate language, and it is certainly not the language of Kotarevshchina. The question of language is another distinguishing marker between the modality of Kotarevshchina, travesties and low humor, and the development of high culture. Andrei Okara makes the point that the Staro-Ukrainska Knyazhna Mova of the 18th century was proscribed by imperial decrees of both Peter and later Catherine the Great as a move to eliminate any competition with Russian as the high language of the empire. There was no need to eliminate daily Ukrainian because it was seen as a low language and not a rival for high status. He goes on to propose that for Ukrainian in the empire, Russian and Ukrainian both functioned as part of the Obshiruskaya kultura, but that a condition of diglossia prevailed, with each language having or serving a different function. Kotlyarevsky, for example, could in principle have found appropriate Ukrainian lexical items for his Oda Sappho. But at the time, high genres were not written in vernacular Ukrainian, and to have written the ode in Ukrainian would be to overturn the prevailing genre hierarchy, treating the ode as a low genre. Again, Ukrainian was circumscribed to a particular kind of literature and only gradually began to break out. As Grabovich has pointed out, Ukrainian did not have a full functioning level of styles. It did not have the full range of social, communal, and cultural functions. The language of the few literary texts in Ukrainian at the beginning of the 19th century, up to 1819, is largely limited to the travesty, burlesque, the Napoleonic anti-ode, and perhaps parts of Pavlovsky's grammar, Grammatica Malorossiyskogo Narechia. That is, lower genres with texts in which the modality of Kotarevshchina dominates. I am intentionally excluding the collections of Ukrainian folk songs by Tsarkiev and Maksimovich, because they are collections of existing material, not the creation of fictional texts. Shevelyov has characterized this stylized modality as follows. Features of this narrative, a la Muzhik, are well known in connection with the prose of Kvitka, Hulak, and Hrebinka. Such features include dialogisms, an excess of vulgarisms and diminutives, a circling round the same word, coordinate syntax and catalogs, avoidance of foreign words and their substitution by descriptive locutions, or approximate ad hoc inventions, or through a folk phonetics and folk etymology, the use of purely local facts with the presumption that they are universally well known, an excess of exclamation, proverbs, interruptions, etc. All of this taken together creates an image mask of a simple, dim-witted provincial narrator. Zarov has gone even further and referred to it as the language of the tavern, kabak. What became necessary then was to distinguish between the language found in these early texts and the spoken language, the narodna mova, that is seen as forming the basis for literary Ukrainian. Current scholarship has used two terms, though not consistently, prosto narodna and narodna mova, to distinguish between the two. The former is sometimes intended to encompass the language of the peasantry, the prostoy or prostyn narod, and sometimes the low, coarse language and vulgarisms that are scattered through texts written in the modality of Kotarevshchina. Narodna mova is seen as the language based on the spoken everyday speech of the people. There was also a high style, fashioned in the neoclassical manner with church Slavonicisms, and used for festive occasions or a pochvalnaya slova, where rhetorical flourishes were expected. The date of 1819 was deliberately mentioned above because it marks the time when a different modality enters Ukrainian literature with Natalka Poltavka. As far as the language goes, Zarov notes that the play utilizes the actual living conversational language of the time. But narodna becomes a somewhat problematic term, inasmuch as it was hotly debated at the time, and can mean of the peasantry or of the people, the nation. The tension is foregrounded by Okara, who qualifies the Ukrainian of the play as Mova Narodna Selyansko-Mishanska. That is presumably a mixed speech of simple folk and somewhat educated urban dwellers. This rather broad range is an effort, I think, to sustain the oft-repeated notion of literary Ukrainian being based on the speech of the simple folk, while acknowledging a difference between the speech of the two classes. In literary works, this resulted in a stylized or literary rendition of spoken speech. In regard to Natalka Poltavka, Okara goes on to state, however, despite the naturalism, the language of Kotlyarevsky's characters, whether the peasants or the city folk, and he lists them, is closer to a fine stylization. Borzenko also makes the point that despite the dictum to write as one speaks, mentioned both by Karamzin and also Kostomariu, the language in literary text does not actually render the real speech of peasants, but a literary version. He notes that Kotlyarevsky's songs are pseudo-folk songs, and the peasants are salon-like, that is, as imagined by the upper-class audience of the comic opera and as appropriate to the genre. Kvitka makes a similar point in one of his letters. He states, living in Ukraine, familiarizing myself with the speech of the inhabitants, I learned to understand their thoughts and made them speak them to the public and in italics in my own words. What we have then is a language hierarchy then, of prosto narodna, and then a literary variant that is clearly distanced from the language of Kotlyarevshchina. The literary variant here is not only shaped by sentimentalism, more on this below, but by a clear rejection of the modality inherent in Kotlyarevshchina. A similar process took place with the literary ballad, a popular genre of the day. As Michael Katz has shown in his literary ballad in early 19th century Russian literature, the raw material of folk songs and folk ballads were reworked into literary form to produce a stylized literary ballad. Walter Scott himself edited original texts to make them more poetic by regularizing the rhythm and eliminating vulgarisms. A similar process is at work with a number of Russian poets of the late 18th century to produce stylized imitations of folk forms. The question remained, however, whether a Ukrainian literary language based on the Narodna Mova was capable of creating serious literary works, as we saw with Hulak's comments regarding his translation of Goethe's ballad, Der Fischer. This point was made earlier by Pavlovsky in 1818 and became a point of contention in the early 1830s between Hulak and Kvitka. Hulak was raised in a neoclassical tradition and was doubtful that the Narodna Mova was adequate for high literature. That is, according to Borzenko, he distinguished high genres with high style from simple Narodna language appropriate for lower genres. Kvitka, in an oft-quoted letter to Plitnyov, wrote, I asked him to write something serious, moving. He kept insisting that the language is awkward and completely unsuited to the task. Even more revealing is Kvitka's letter of 1834 regarding his collection Maloroссийские повести, рассказываемые Рицком Основьяненком, 1834. They were written to settle a dispute, he states, that in our language you can't write anything serious or tender, only coarse, vulgar, and blasphemous things. The goal for Kvitka was to write not a text in the usual modality of Kotlyarevshchina, but a new kind of Ukrainian literary text, an example of which was to be his story Marusia, as he clearly stated in another of his letters. Referring again to his disagreement with Hulak, he wrote, knowing his views, I wrote Marusia and proved that one can be deeply moved by the Little Russian language. It is evident that a different kind of writing is being juxtaposed to the established tradition that is viewed as a shortcoming. Kvitka makes the point even more forcefully in his Supplica do Pana Izdatelya. Because there are people in this world, this is a quote, because there are people in this world who make fun of us and say and write that supposedly none of our people can, as they say, cut it to produce something tender and intelligent and useful, and that in our language you can't write anything other than cursing and mocking a fool. A similar view is expressed by Borovikovsky in his 1836 letter to Maksimovich. It is not true that Ukrainian is only suited for expressing the comical and brutal. The defense of Ukrainian is certainly one of the points being made in these letters. But the other more central point I wish to emphasize is that the new direction in literature cannot be achieved with the modality at hand. Not only do outsiders, presumably Russians, find the coarse humor vulgarisms as rather lowbrow, but even Ukrainian authors are searching for a new means of expression, a new style lexicon by which to create an alternative modality in Ukrainian literature that will bring it closer to high culture or serious literature. A new modality begins to appear in Ukrainian literature in 1819 with the appearance of Natalka Poldavka and the increasing presence of sentimentalism. Sentimentalism focuses on fine feelings, the emotions and purity of the heart, on the subjective psychology of the individual. It prefers the naturalness of the noble peasant over the veneer of the urbane gentleman, the countryside or province to the imperial centers, and the natural world to the artificiality of high society. This movement swept across Europe, significantly influenced Ukrainian literature, producing what Zarev has called the second line in Ukrainian literature. The new conception of the individual brings with it new aesthetic expectations that could not be possibly fulfilled with the modality of Kotlyarevshchina with its coarse language, earthy humor, and dim-witted provincial narrator. This forces Ukrainian literature to refine and develop the literary language in order to convey fine and tender sentiments. This is evident in the speech of Natalka and Petro, the young lovers in Natalka Poltavka. The play, called the Maloroссийская опера, is light fare with entertaining songs and has the expected comic and satiric elements of the comedy along with its happy ending. The comical characters, however, are Panvozny and Viborny, members of the educated middle class who speak in a mix of Russian, Ukrainian, officialese, etc., and are similar to comical and ridiculous figures of the genre. In this text, it is the peasants who are portrayed positively rather than disparagingly, as crude, vulgar, or simple-minded as in Kotlyarevshchina. The sentimentalist treatment of the peasantry was largely shaped by Rousseau, whose writings made their way into the Russian Empire. In the Kharkiv region, his views were also spread by an admirer, Jean Vernet, a Frenchman who settled in the Kharkiv area, worked on the Ukrainsky Vesnik and New Kvitka well. Rousseau treats the peasant as noble and high-minded, thus making him an idealized and elevated subject. And this is certainly true in Natalka Poltavka. Both Natalka and Petro are honest to a fault, obedient, honoring one's parents, modest, devout, placing their trust in God, unselfish and morally superior to their social superiors. Unlike the conflict of duty and love in neoclassical tragedy, in which duty wins out, here in the conflict between duty, obedience to parents, that is Natalka's mother, and the truth of one's heart, the pure heart reigns victorious and is sanctioned by the divine will as God brings the loving hearts together. By elevating the subject, the peasantry, this way, virtually all associated with them needs to be elevated as well, including the language. The language of the simple folk is viewed as pure, natural, that is, original, genuine, unadulterated by imitations of foreign speech. In the Ukrainian context, the Narodna Mova is in a stylized form and is now elevated. That is, the change in status of the theme or the subject matter, treating the peasant as noble, as a noble individual, means that one cannot speak of elevated matters in coarse, rough language, perhaps not even in overly common language. The play was also staged in Moscow and St. Petersburg and was well received by the public there. The Russian critic of Severnaya Pchela specifically praised the true and warm feelings of the heart expressed by the peasant lovers. What is apparent here is that Ukrainian text conforms to the established accepted genre, the comic opera, and the modality of sentimentalism that placed it above the coarse travesties that characterized literature in Ukrainian for a broad audience. If Kotlyarevshchina often presented dim-witted provincial narrators, a peasant in unflattering terms, sentimentalism reversed the polarity and embraced the peasantry, admittedly an idealized peasantry. The peasant milieu and ethos were sanitized in the literary version, and the values of devotion, high morals, fine feelings of love, usually assigned to positive characters of upper social classes, were now being assigned to the peasantry. The peasants thus end up the equal of their social superiors in terms of individual human qualities, an issue that resonated with the reading public since Karamzin's Poor Liza in 1792. Notwithstanding the incongruities mentioned by Zerov, excessive sentimentality in the story, lack of realism, Kotlyarevsky produced a Ukrainian text, the equal of literature of the empire. In so doing, he moved literature in Ukrainian beyond the one-dimensionality and lowbrow status associated with Kotlyarevshchina. The change was partially driven by the outside influence of sentimentalism that required a new modality of Ukrainian literature. But Kotlyarevsky's achievement was to imbue the Ukrainian colorit in the positive peasant characters, Natalka, Petro, and even Mykola, and their ethos with the level of dignity. Entering the broader shared sphere of sentimentalism in the empire was not a threat to Ukrainian distinctiveness. It did not bleach out the specifically Ukrainian ethnos with its customs, rituals, etc., as one can readily see from Kvitka's Marusia. The story he offered is an example of serious literature in Ukrainian. Ukrainian distinctiveness is introduced throughout this text, as Zerov shows, but is especially pronounced in two lengthy episodes describing Ukrainian folk customs, the courting ritual and the zhalovanya and the burial ritual. The courting with the elders, the staroste, is presented in detail, their dress, elaborate metaphorical speeches, obedience of the children, the entreaties of the two with its folkloric images and diminutives, and then developed further in the second encounter when Naum, Marusia's father, finally gives his consent. The engagement ceremony with its embroidered towels, endless bowing and appropriate turns of phrase, the drinking and short rhymed speeches, the songs of the visiting village girls, all convey the peasant milieu but in dignified fashion. The story with its tragic end, Marusia falls ill and dies before Vasil returns, concludes with more ritual details, this time of the mourning and the funeral, which even brought the masses from the city to witness the way old traditions are still observed in the village. Some contemporaries, such as Mastiak, found the descriptions excessive, overloaded with descriptions. He complained that Kvitka's descriptions had little bearing on the plot. I would like to suggest that the description, the kolorit, is intentionally meant to convey the distinctiveness of the Ukrainian ethnos, but even more crucial to their treatment, No aspect of their customs are mocked or made comical. Rather, they are venerated, even if old-fashioned. This is not the comical Ukrainian provincial world one encounters in Gogol's Evenings on a Farm, 1831 and 32, or in Kotlyarevshchina. The stature of this milieu is enhanced by the behavior of its peasant inhabitants, especially the young lovers in the story, Marusia and Vasil. As in Natalka Poltavka, the two are presented as exemplary and idealized people. Both are obedient to parents, chaste, pure, extremely honest, modest, and devout. Physical contact, even a kiss, is viewed as a possible sin by Marusia, as would be hiding Vasil's courting from her parents. As Vasil pledges he will treasure her and that no foul or polluted devilish thought will come to his heart. The world for them and her parents is guided by God, whose plan cannot be grasped by mortals, but whose goodness is not doubted even with Marusia's death. Of course, these are idealized peasants. But the point of contemporaries of comparison here is not realism, but Kotlyarevshchina. Despite the melodrama of the story and the conventional plot, the peasants are raised to a higher power by virtue of their values and their manner of speech, expression. This is precisely the dignity of the Ukrainian ethnos and the simple folk that is at stake for Kvitka. Kvitka's concern with the issue is expressed in a text that at first glance would not seem well suited to the task. The history, Головарти матеріал для історії Малої Росії, which appeared in 1839 in Russia. Ostensibly, it is a response to a brief mention of two Kozak songs that appeared in Vadim Pasek's publication. The former song pertains to Catherine's granting the former Kozaks of the siege a new home on the Tamany Peninsula for their faithful service in the Russo-Turkish War. His story is not an alternative history, the true story that proves Pasek wrong. It is an explanation of how this all came about through the efforts of Antin Holovaty, whom Kvitka, as a young boy, met at the family home. There are three episodes in particular that show the extent to which dignity is at stake for Kvitka. One of these episodes, and they all follow the same pattern, Well, Avanti is initially presented as popularly imagined, a coarse, uncouth, uncultured Zaporozhian. But then when he sits down to speak with Kvitka's father in Ukrainian, the narrator notes the coarseness disappeared, and he spoke beautifully, ably, freely, on things that could not be expressed so accurately and powerfully in Russian. Not only is the distinctness of Ukrainian asserted, but more importantly, the capability of the language to achieve the qualities characteristic of high culture, rather than a rough peasant dialect. In the second such episode, the pattern remains the same. On the way to Petersburg, Holovaty and some companions stop by the Osnovyanenko homestead when some local town officials and their wives come visiting. One of the wives, wanting to speak with the Cossack, poses a provocative question while slipping into the Malorossiysky pronunciation. The Cossack bowed in a complete worldly grace and answered her in refined Russian. Kvitka makes explicit that the lady expects coarse behavior that corresponds to the general low opinion of the Cossacks and is taken aback. The episode again is of no consequence to the historical narrative. There are no historically significant personages involved. The episode is introduced solely to dispel the unfavorable popular image and assert the equality and status of the Cossacks in proper society. These two episodes, which subvert the misconception about the Cossacks and Holovaty, are a prelude to the grand finale, that is, Holovaty's arrival in Petersburg and encounter with Catherine the Great herself. The main point is that Holovaty, in breaking protocol, that is, speaking to or addressing Catherine herself, he speaks intelligently and properly to the amazement of the courtiers and the reader, of course, who conclude that the shaved head is able to think and speak just like those with the powdered and curled heads. What follows are illustrations of Holovaty's native ability to grasp the workings of power structured court and turn them to his advantage, in part by his natural and genuine devotion to the Empress, who appreciates his honest, if colorful, assessments and directness. What is crucial is that the Cossack Volnost has been now integrated into the structure of the empire, and that the Cossacks can function equally well in high society when necessary. That is, all the positive qualities Kvitka introduces assures that they are not the simple country bumpkins encountered in Ukrainian comical tall tales. Instead, he imbues them with a natural dignity. The concern with dignity was also pronounced among the Romantics, who held a deeply reverent attitude toward the Narod, the simple folk, and took a critical attitude toward Kotlyarevsky and Kotlyarevshchina. Kulish was particularly vicious in his criticism, accusing Kotlyarevsky of caricaturing the simple folk and their language, and exposing them to the ridicule of the world. And Shevchenko was also critical of his Eneida, calling it a smichovena na moskovsky gestalt. Kostomariov, in his Obzor sochinenia pisanikh na malorossiyskom narechii, had praise for the fullness of Little Russian life, customs, and characters in the in the text, but was critical of the trivialities, some scenes and repugnant descriptions, of which, unfortunately, he notes, there were many in Kotlyarevsky. Their criticism was directed not at the subject matter that establishes Ukrainian distinctiveness, the people, the colorit, and the language, but what they viewed as denigrating treatment of the subject matter, the denial of its inherent dignity. And it is not surprising, then, that they had high regard for Natalka Poltavka and Marusia. Kostomariov praised the fine feelings expressed in the play and was especially effusive about Marusia. Kulish too had high praise for Kvitka's story, but despite the high regard for Kvitka, Shevchenko, after all, dedicated an early poem to him, the Romantics expressed some revealing reservations. Shevchenko wrote the following in 1847, after Kvitka's death in 1843. The late Osnovyanenko observed the Narod very astutely, but he didn't catch their language, perhaps because he didn't hear it in the cradle from his mother. And Kostomariov had reservations about the artistic merit and forced sentiment of Marusia. Both statements reveal a different aesthetic orientation of the Romantics, in which artistry is viewed as false and simplicity is genuine. What is evident in the Narod is an inherent natural given, what one hears from the cradle from one's mother, rather than the stylized speech of art. This is evident in Kostomariov's marked praise for the naturalness in Kvitka's sincere love. The claim of artlessness in folk songs and among the people is, of course, another myth. And just as the sentimentalists idealized the Narod in Rousseauist fashion, so the Romantics mythologized the Narod in Herderian fashion. This is not merely saying that all art is imagined, constructive, is artifice. Rather, that dignity has become an aesthetic value through the forms of its expression. The aesthetics of neoclassicism, sentimentalism, and romanticism all rejected the modality of low humor and travesty as appropriate or not fit for, and inadequate, not capable of, high art. That is, the travesty has its place, but not as high art. The first two movements came to emphasize literary elegance in art, understood literally or metaphorically, as suited for the court, salon, or educated readership. Lower social classes, simple folk, had to be raised in stature to appear in such art. A trivial but telling example occurs in a late 18th century Russian comic opera, where peasant girls sing songs in French. In this stylized presentation of the peasantry, accuracy is not the goal. Rather, izashnost, elegance or grace is, as Kostomariv also notes in his Obzor. Similarly, the prostonarodna mova, actual speech of the lower classes, is not appropriate for a heroine or hero, although it may be used to render the speech of minor characters. Within this horizon of expectations, Ukrainian literature of the early 19th century, travesties and texts in the modality of Kotlevshchina, are seen as lacking by Russians and many Ukrainians. As Grabovich has noted, and at this stage of Russian perception of Ukrainian literature already had its own voice, but without dignity or elegance. It has been my contention that this provokes a counter-reaction among several Ukrainian authors for whom dignitas and a high style become part of the pursuit of high culture. For romanticism, narodnost, trumpeted in Kostomariv's Obzor, becomes the catch-all term intended to provide dignity and a new high style based on the spoken language. But as mentioned earlier, this too is a mythology, a literary imagining that will be challenged by realism in its claim of rendering everyday reality. Realism will go further in its departure from stylization by introducing the ugly, the truth of life as a fitting subject for literature. That is, realism subverts the aesthetic of the previous literary movements mentioned here, including the exalted view of the Narod. What one sees in early 19th century Ukrainian literature is that distinctiveness is an issue for Ukrainians keen on asserting their own identity in the face of an overwhelming imperial presence. Distinctiveness, however, is not in itself self-sufficient. There is no problem for any empire to acknowledge the presence of minor, local, or peripheral culture, people, or literature, since these pose no threat to the empire. Ukrainians could remain a dancing and singing people, and their language and literature appropriate for home use. One sees this in the 1840s, when Ukrainian literature largely disappears from the imperial discourse. It becomes a matter for Ukrainians, but not of much interest to Russians. The challenge or threat to the empire arises when a people begin to create and assert its own high culture and thus offer a serious rival narrative. As an example, one can mention the denial of permission to publish the translation of the Bible into Ukrainian. The Russian ministry quickly realized the danger of acknowledging Ukrainian as a language capable of attaining high culture or high status. It is not surprising that toward the end of the 19th century, major translations of acknowledged high Western European literature began to appear. Shakespeare, Dante, parts of the Iliad, the Odyssey, the complete Bible, and Schiller, Goethe, Heine, Molière, Rostand, Baudelaire, Maeterlinck, Hauptmann, D'Annunzio, and others, all published outside the Russian Empire, because the ban on translating foreign works into Ukrainian was not lifted until 1905, and that is a consequence of the revolution of 1905. The pursuit of creating a distinctive Ukrainian high culture meant creating a different modality, language, tone, style, than provided by the very text that initially defined Ukrainian distinctiveness. This curse of the province forced Ukrainian writers to find an adequate means of expressing the Ukrainian colorit and ethnos, a process that lasted throughout the 19th century and ended up fueling the debate between Ukrainian populists and modernists in the early 20th century. Thank you.